Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad crossed President Obama's red line when he used chemical weapons on his own people in 2013. Yesterday, President Trump said many, many of his lines were crossed when, this week, the Syrian dictator apparently gassed his own people once again. Just a week earlier, administration officials were saying they could live with Assad in power. Now they're saying we must act. President Trump owns the Syria challenge now. How will he handle it? This hour on Point, the chemical gas attack in Syria and the president's response. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen the videos emerging from Syria? What do you want from this president? Hands off, as he promised so many times, or action here? And with Steve Bannon bumped from the NSC Principals Committee in the middle of this story, do you see a White House getting it together on foreign policy or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Yesterday at the United Nations Security Council, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, held up two photos of victims from the chemical attack in Syria and implored her colleagues to act.
We awoke to pictures, to children foaming at the mouth, suffering convulsions, being carried in the arms of desperate parents. We saw rows of lifeless bodies, some still in diapers, some with visible scars of a chemical weapons attack. Look at those pictures. We cannot close our eyes to those pictures. We cannot close our minds of the responsibility to act.
Children foaming at the mouth. Joining me first today from Beirut, Lebanon, for the latest on the Syrian gas attack is Sarah Aldeeb. She covers Syria and Lebanon for the Associated Press. Sarah, thank you very much for being with us. What is the latest that is coming out of Syria? What's the latest that we know about the death toll and the source of this chemical attack, Sarah?
Hi, Tom, and thanks for having me. The last we're hearing about the death toll is that it's likely to climb. That's the last I got from a doctor that is on tour in a town, still looking at the aftermath of the attack. He says that so far they have 82 names of people that were killed on Tuesday, the day the gas was dispensed in their town, and that they are likely to see a rise in death toll because there are still unknown bodies and they are still looking for missing people. There are 500 people that are injured. At least 30 of those are being treated in Turkey, and 3 of the 30 that were treated in Turkey died from the impact. So this is the death toll and the victims in numbers. Today, Turkish officials announced that the autopsies from the people that died in Turkey revealed that they were subjected to some kind of chemical attack. So I think this is the closest we've got to take out suspected chemical attack from our coverage. There is an official, there is an autopsy, and the people that were in the town had to deal with it.
Sarah, Russian officials have claimed that these were chemical weapons that had been stored by rebels and hit by Syrian government bombs. Is there any credibility to that at this point?
This is an official announcement. This is what we have. We haven't seen any pictures of the warehouse that they say they've targeted. And what we're hearing from people on the ground is that the rockets, the airstrikes, the rockets and the airstrikes happen in a populated area, residential area, where one of the largest clans of the town live. That's why we see at least 25 of those same family member killed in the attack. So, and then having spoken to some people in the area at trying to look for anything that looks like a warehouse, what I understand from residents is that this area is where the wheat silos for the town used to be, but the government had destroyed those in previous airstrikes and attacks in the area. So, as you know, this is a six-year-old war, so this has been happening for some time. There's also a bakery, there's also a fuel depot, and there were also just residences. So we have not seen any evidence of that warehouse that was targeted.
Is it then at this point the consensus of governments in the region, of observers, of reports you're getting out, that it was, that the source was the Assad government? Is it fair to say that, Sarah?
I'm not an investigator. I tell you what I'm hearing and what I'm seeing, what I'm able to verify. And so far, there's always a question mark in Syria because we don't have the ability to report from the ground. It's been the case for a number of years because of security concerns and because kidnapping and journalists were subjected to numerous violent attacks. But what we're able to gather and we're able to verify is that this was an air attack, and the government, the Russians, and the coalition have airplanes operating in the area, and no one has pointed the finger at Russia. I mean, I think most people believe that this has been the history of the Syrian government. They have been proven to have done this before. So I'm not a court, but I'm telling you what we have ruled out, at least.
Sarah El-Deeb with us from Beirut, covering Syria and Lebanon there for the Associated Press. Sarah, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Here's the sound from a pro-rebel news service from Khan Sheikhoun. This is the town in rebel-held Idlib province where the gas attacks allegedly took place on Tuesday. In the video, emergency responders are hosing off Syrians here who had breathed in the poison. You can hear a child victim gasping for air. And hear more sirens, volunteers rushing to carry an unconscious man to an ambulance. And this 13-year-old Mazin Youssef describing what he experienced during the chemical attack, as response interpreted by CNN correspondent Ben Wiedemann.
I saw the explosion in front of my grandfather's house, he recalls. I ran to their house barefoot. I saw my grandfather sitting like this, suffocated. Then I became dizzy. How many of his relatives were killed? 19, he responds.
It's a big number, and the number is climbing, as we just heard there from Beirut. With us now from Washington is Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Nahal, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Last week, we heard Rex Tillerson saying Syrians will sort this out, and Nikki Haley also making noises like this is not where the U.S. is going to be involved. This week, after these attacks, an unusual and different sound from the Trump administration, both from the U.N. ambassador and from the president himself. Is there a real change in policy? Is there a real chance of some U.S. action here at this point? The Obama administration didn't do it. Might the Trump administration do it now?
Well, they're certainly making a lot of noise about wanting to do something. But what that something is what's the mystery. President Trump says he's horrified by the pictures of the dying children. He says that he feels like this is his responsibility now. But he doesn't say what he's going to do. He says he doesn't like to telegraph his actions when it comes to the military. The problem is that you have a limited set of options in Syria. You can do airstrikes. You can try sanctions on Russia or Iran, more sanctions, I should add. But the question is, will that be enough? Will that lead to an outcome that is satisfactory for every side? And there's also the possibility of, if you do an airstrike, for instance, well, maybe that'll scare Assad for a little bit. But then if you don't do another one, he might just go back to doing what he's been doing. So it's been really interesting to watch the administration make a lot of noise and say, well, you know what, nothing's off the table and we're going to work with our partners. But unless they actually do something and find something that is new and will actually work, then it could end up being just a lot of hot air and ultimately could make them look very weak.
But it's talk. The talk is of action. Donald Trump talking about this yesterday, Oval Office meeting with Jordan's King Abdullah, reacting here to the chemical attack in Syria.
These are very troubled times in the Middle East. And we see what happened just recently, yesterday in Syria. Horrible, horrible thing. Unspeakable.
And the American president saying this is way beyond a red line.
When you kill innocent children, innocent babies, little babies, with a chemical gas that is so lethal. People were shocked to hear what gas it was that crosses many, many lines beyond the red line, many, many lines.
And then, Nahal, stick with us. I want to go to the UN, where it was, of course, Nikki Haley. Here she was saying she's tired of talk. It's time for action.
When the United Nations consistently fails in its duty to act collectively, there are times in the life of states that we are compelled to take our own action.
Our own action. And this from the U.S. ambassador to the UN.
The world needs to see the use of chemical weapons and the fact that they will not be tolerated.
Well, easy to say and hard to do. The Obama administration ultimately laid out that red line and then went in a different direction. Nahal Tusi, the understanding was that the Assad regime in the aftermath of that the 2013 attacks had gotten rid of its chemical weapons. So what do we learn here?
Well, there are some remarkable aspects to all of this. First of all, it is entirely possible that Assad did not fully get rid of his entire stockpile. It's possible he's managed to procure some additional sarin or other types of gas. So that is something that international investigators really need to get to the bottom of. And it is fair to say that some have said for a long time that they are not convinced that Assad got rid of everything, because he never really, really fully declared everything. And even when there have been attacks in recent years, he has used chemicals like chlorine, which technically were not part of the original deal because chlorine has so many different uses. So it's been a very vague and mystifying part of all this. But what really I want to add is that strikes me about what Trump and Nikki Haley and others are saying now is that, look, this is not the first chemical attack to happen in Syria. It is not even the worst chemical attack to happen. Children have been dying in such attacks for years. When this happened in 2013, President Trump himself told President Obama on Twitter and through other means, don't bomb Syria. Don't go into this. But this was happening the whole time.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the chemical attack, the gas attack in Syria, the Trump response, Steve Bannon's National Security Council Principles Committee exit, and what comes next. You can join us this hour. What do you think of this whole situation? What should the U.S. do? Is there something the U.S. should do here? The president said, never mind Assad, let's focus on ISIS. Is that still right? And when Russia just shrugs and points fingers, can the U.S. work with them? What's it mean to you that Steve Bannon is now off the Central Principles Committee of the National Security Council in the midst of all this? Nahal Tusi is with us from Politico, foreign affairs correspondent there, joining us from Washington. Robin Wright joins us in a minute. Here's an interview with the BBC, a Syrian doctor, describing what he saw in survivors of the chemical attack in that little Syrian town.
The symptoms that we witnessed are different than symptoms of chlorine gas. All the victims who arrived had neural stress and yellow saliva coming out of their mouths. And very soon, blood started coming out of their mouths, too, which means that their lungs are damaged.
When the Obama administration saw chemical attacks, Donald Trump said, don't do it, Mr. President, to Barack Obama. Don't go in there. Here he was in 2015 on CBS's Face the Nation. Host John Dickerson asked Donald Trump what he would do as president if the Syrian dictatorship used chemical weapons. And here's what he said.
Assad apparently used chemical weapons on his own people. Does President Trump use force or not in that
case?
Well,
you know, the time to have done it would have been when he drew the line in the sand.
So you would have done it in that case?
I might have gone in. Yeah, I think it's terrible. When you start using that, I think it's terrible. Now it's such a mess over there with everybody involved, and the airspace is very limited. You know, it's not that big an area. The airspace is very limited. So now you have, what are we going to start, World War III over Syria?
You want to start World War III over Syria. But yesterday at a joint press conference with the Jordanian king at the White House, President Trump said his attitude towards Syria has changed.
I will tell you, it's already happened, that my attitude toward Syria and Assad has changed very much. And if you look back over the last few weeks, there were other attacks using gas. You're now talking about a whole different level.
President Trump yesterday. Nahal Tusi with Politico, please stand by in Washington. Robin Wright joins us from Washington as well via Skype, contributing writer for The New Yorker, joint fellow at the Wilson Center in the U.S. Institute of Peace, a longtime correspondent in this region for The Washington Post. Robin Wright, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Always great to be with you, Tom.
Can you imagine a scenario in which this president, after everything he said during the campaign, now actually takes some action here, military action or otherwise, that would be a significant response to the government of Bashar al-Assad, if that's where the finger of guilt points here?
I can imagine that he might engage in some kind of airstrikes, on limited airstrikes, to send a message to the Assad regime. But I think the chances at the moment probably are lower for a lot of reasons. As he pointed out when he was campaigning, this is a very complicated issue, and it does endanger a wider conflagration. This is taking on the Russians, who have now are now playing a very important role militarily in Syria, using their own air power, and it certainly would pull the rug out from any kind of diplomatic cooperation with the Russians. I think the irony of all this is that President Trump finds himself in exactly the same boat that President Obama did in 2013. And what do you do without engaging or taking on responsibility for what happens in Syria down the road? The pottery barn rule, as Colin Powell once called it, once you get involved, once you assume some kind of responsibility for some aspect of Syrian behavior, then you're culpable for a role or responsibility for what happens next. Now, the interesting thing is that the Secretary of State goes to Russia on Wednesday, April 12th, to talk with his counterpart, his first, you know, important inner exchange with President Putin and other Russian leaders. And this is a moment where clearly Syria will be at the top of the agenda. You know, until just Monday and Tuesday, there was a sense in Washington that President Trump was prepared to accept Assad as the leader of Syria, kind of for an indefinite or open-ended transition. The press secretary had said that it would be silly to talk about ousting Assad, given the political realities on the ground. And Nikki Haley, who took a brave position at the UN this week, said just last week, yes, they thought Assad was a hindrance, but the U.S. was not looking to oust him. And now we're talking about a different ballgame. The problem for Washington has always been, however, okay, if you don't like Assad, what's the alternative? And the U.S. has backed a series of rebel groups and political opposition groups, and none of them have been able to put forward a viable alternative as a political leader or as someone who could facilitate a transition. And this has complicated Washington's ability to talk about what it wants to see happen in Syria, that the only initiative out there is Russia, and the only one that controls at least a good part of Syria, a third of Syria, but still has probably more than 30% of the support of the population, is President Assad. So it complicates whether it's military action or political diplomacy.
Robin, and Nahal, I wonder about the timing of this chemical attack. I mean, if this is Assad, and you know that seems to be the emerging consensus here, he had to know that there would be a very hot response, and there has been right up to the Security Council. So why now? I mean, you've had finger-pointing in Washington by Republicans saying, in effect, that maybe the Trump administration drew this action with its own sort of green light to a longer-term tenure for Bashar al-Assad. This was Senator John McCain on Tuesday saying that the decision not to prioritize ending that civil war and getting rid of Assad was disgraceful, saying that Russia and Assad had probably been glad to hear of the change in U.S. policy under Donald Trump.
I'm sure they're encouraged to know that the United States is withdrawing and seeking some kind of new arrangement with the Russians, and it is another disgraceful chapter in American history, and it was predictable.
Another disgraceful chapter and predictable. And here's another Republican. Of course, both of these guys have had their run-ins with Donald Trump. But here was Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Republican. An interview with AM Tampa Bay yesterday morning saying that no coincidence the Syrian regime was gassing its citizens just days after the Trump administration said they'd be okay with the dictator remaining in power there.
It's concerning that the Secretary of State 72 hours ago or a week ago, last Friday, said, you know, that this is the future's up to the people of, in Syria on what happens with Assad, in essence almost nodding to the idea that Assad was going to get to stay in some capacity. I don't think it's a coincidence that a few days later we see this.
Not a coincidence, says Senator Marco Rubio. Nahal Tusi, what about the timing of this attack? What sense can be made of it?
Well, there are those who say that perhaps Assad felt emboldened by what the Trump administration was saying last week. And then there is the theory that Assad is trying to test Trump, doing this attack and seeing what the reaction is going to be. You know, one thing to also bear in mind is this is dominating the headlines, well, yesterday, and it might be to some degree today. But in a few days, this actually might vanish, and the Trump administration might focus entirely on something else. So another key part of this whole debate as to what the administration will do is whether it's going to continue to get pressure to actually do anything in the first place. If you have other issues come to the fore, whether it's relations with North Korea, for example, or other aspects of our relationship with Russia, this might just fade, and the Trump administration may feel that it doesn't necessarily have to do anything. Now, if you also look at what's going on the Hill, you have a number of lawmakers from every front saying, we have to take action, we have to do something. Assad has to be held, quote, accountable. But few of them are offering a lot of specifics. Tom Cotton has said, you know what, maybe military action is an option. And others have said, let's bring Assad up on war crimes charges, although it's not clear why that would matter to Assad whatsoever. And then there's a possibility of sanctions. But there's not a lot of definitive, for sure, actions that anybody on the Hill is definitely going to rally behind. And when it comes to military action in particular, airstrikes or whatever, Trump may find that he has a hard time getting a lot of people on board for that. But there is one thing he has, which is an advantage. He's a Republican, and the Republicans control Congress right now. Now, when Obama was in the White House, the Republicans didn't really want to work with him on anything. But this time around, they might feel like if Trump wants to do something, whether it's military or otherwise, they have to support their president. He's a Republican, and he needs a win politically.
So of course, that is one advantage. The president has a lot of leeway here as commander-in-chief when it comes to this kind of action. Robin Wright, help us think about the timing of this. From the Syria side, is there a war logic to this attack at this time in the fighting on the ground? And then from the Washington side, that this comes at the same time, in the same week, as we now see Steve Bannon out from that core of the National Security Council. But start with the Syrian side, if you would, Robin. Is there some battle line that had reached such a fever pitch that chemical warfare, which is a kind of psychological attack, big death toll here, but that makes sense? What's going on in the fighting or the movement there that might explain this or anything?
Well, who knows what the Assad thinking is on this? This is a regime that father and son has been in power almost half a century now, and they have repeatedly turned to force, very gruesome types of force, against their own people. His father killed somewhere between 10,000 and 25,000 people in 1982 when I lived in the Middle East in a place called Hama. This is not the first use of chemical weapons, as was pointed out earlier. And he got away with it in the past, by and large. You know, he had to give some chemical weapons in, but the regime was allowed to survive and continue killing its own people. And so, it sounds nice from the perspective of the Hill to say there's cause and effect, and maybe it is indeed that. But I think that, as you pointed out, this is a psychological weapon, and it happened in Idlib, and we need to understand that strategically Idlib, a province in the northwest, mm-hmm. is the one area of Syria where the opposition still rules or controls, and you have a lot of different opposition forces. You have an al-Qaeda franchise called the Nusra Front. You have U.S.-backed rebels. You have a lot of people in a wide spectrum in between, and the Idlib is the one area where that is still a thorn in the side of the regime because they haven't been able to crack it and and force out or kill the rebels. And so this is a means of terrorizing the population, perhaps undermining their support, the various support for the militia groups, the opposition groups that dominate in Idlib. So it's a strategic issue. It's a psychological issue. And there may be a bit of testing the administration out as well. But this is a regime that never has a conscience. And the idea of having a neat cause and effect or a singular cause and effect may be imposing a little bit of Western thinking rather than what's going on in the minds of Bashar al-Assad.
Robin Wright, Nahal Tusi, please stand by. Let me get some callers in here. Dolores in Waterford, Pennsylvania. Dolores, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, all your guests. I guess due to the complexity of the environment in Syria, obviously there was never any way to verify as to whether or not Assad got rid of his chemical weapons. And I guess my question is, do we know if he still has the capability to manufacture these weapons, or could he have been supplied by the Russians, and even the Russians could have dropped those chemical weapons? And to the best of my recollection, Senator Kerry has been the only one that has called these atrocities by the Assad regime war crimes. Now, my question is it in the hands of the UN to declare these type of actions as war crimes, and that Bashar Assad and his associates, as long as maybe even Russians, could be officially declared as war criminals, so that they
Dolores,
can be
let us pick it. Let us pick it all up, and I appreciate your call, Robin. Let me come first to you on the chemical weapons there. I mean, people are talking about sarin gas. This is very lethal. I don't know if that's exactly what we've got this time, but some saying that the symptoms are along those lines. What about the sourcing? After 2013, when there was the agreement to get rid of them, was there some attempt to verify? How does that happen? And where do these kind of agents come from, Robin? Hello, Robin, are you there? Nahal, can you respond to those questions?
I'll do my best. Several years ago in 2013, after Assad used chemical weapons and killed hundreds of people, there was a deal struck that involved the U.S. and Russians and others, including the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is an independent body, to remove the stockpile. The strong belief was that most, if not all, of Assad's chemical weapons were moved out. But in the years since, there have still been some chemical weapons used in certain attacks. And so increasingly, intelligence officials and others have come to believe that not everything has been moved. Although in a number of cases, chlorine was used, and that's a bit more complicated in terms of its legality. And so the growing sense now is that he does have something, but what's not clear is how much he has, where exactly he's getting it from. Whether the Russians are giving it to him is it's questionable. I think the Russians were not happy when he used chemical weapons the first time. This is not something that they want to see normalized in a theater of war. It's not something anybody really wants to see become normal in war. And so that is a very sensitive and questionable thing. But in terms of his continued use of weapons, it seems as if he does have something. How much? That's just going to be up to international investigators to find out if they can get the access that they need.
Robin, I think we've got you back here. What about war crimes? Who says or levels a formal charge along those lines? And would it make any difference?
I think it would make an important difference, but I doubt that the Russians are going to go along with it. And whether it's at a UN, in a UN resolution, whether it's action taken at the international, the ICC, International Criminal Court, there are a number of different steps. Requires a lot of documentation, a chain of evidence that would prove this. It's a long, laborious process, and it's certainly a possibility, but it doesn't address the immediate challenge of what does the international community do. And at the moment, it's very divided. Now, one of the interesting things is the Russians have not blamed
claim that the regime is not responsible. The Iranians are in an awkward position because they have taken a very tough position on the use of chemical weapons because they lost tens of thousands of people to chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, and they were pretty tough on Assad. Their close ally, they've propped him up, provided him with, you know, millions of dollars in aid, military advisors, and so forth. So they will have a say in this process, and this is going to embarrass them as well.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the chemical attack, the gas attack in Syria, and the Trump response. Ahal Tusi is with us, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico from Washington. Robin Wright is here, author of Rock the Kasbah and Dreams and Shadows, longtime correspondent for the Washington Post in this region. Terrible scenes out of the town where these apparently nerve agents were deployed. Here was Abu Mustafa, eyewitness to the suspected to the chemical attack, telling Agence France-Presse what he saw. Saying the city was targeted at 7, 7:30 this morning. We were getting dressed to go to work. We're farmers. My friend Abu Muhammad, may he rest in peace, is among the martyrs. His three children and his wife also died. I went to their house to see them. They were all dead. People, women, were dying in their homes, in the streets, in front of their homes. Some had blood coming out of their mouths. They're from AFP. Just last week, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said in a press conference in Turkey that the United States did not consider Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's removal a priority.
The status and the longer-term status of President Assad will be decided by the Syrian people.
If they're alive. Of course, this week, different sound. Here's Republican Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas telling MSNBC's Morning Joe yesterday that Assad must not remain in power. This is a Republican senator following this latest attack, suggesting the Trump administration consider all options to remove him.
I think we have to be prepared to keep all options on the table, whether it's military action or whether it's classified covert activities as well. But ultimately, we cannot expect to be safe ourselves from the threats emanating from the Middle East as long as Bashar al-Assad remains in power.
Republican Senator Tom Cotton. Ahal Tusi, Robin Wright, please stand by. Wael Al-Zayat joins us right now, Syrian American, diplomat during the Bush administration in Iraq. He was senior policy advisor on Iraq and Syria to the U.S. permanent rep to the U.N., Samantha Power. He's now CEO of the nonprofit Emerge USA, works to increase Muslim American civic engagement in American politics, teaches international relations at Georgetown University. Wael Al-Zayat, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for having me.
In 2016, there was this internal memo at the State Department sharply critical of the Obama administration policy in Syria, saying there should be military strikes against the government of Assad to stop violations of a ceasefire in that country's civil war. My understanding is, Wael, that you, in fact, were the author of that memo. Is that true? And would you suggest a strike now?
Tom, I was one of the main co-authors with a few colleagues at the State Department, fellow diplomats, where we strongly believed then, we still believe now, obviously, that the only forward in Syria to protect civilians, to address the hemorrhaging refugee crisis, the radicalization of the country and the region, and to protect us here at home requires establishing deterrence in Syria. And unfortunately, I would like it to be done through peaceful means, but we clearly need limited military strikes to convince the Syrian regime to stop targeting its own people.
What would you strike? Where? And how would you try and make sure that the U.S. planes weren't shot down by Russians?
Well, the nice thing about us is we have an area of weapons and choices. You know, we have standoff capabilities from the Mediterranean. The point here is not to establish a no-fly zone or to start a new, you know, Middle Eastern war of occupation or regime overthrow. None whatsoever. But through our various military means, we can send a signal to the regime at a time and a place of our choosing. We surely can do that. And then follow it on with concerted, focused, and strong negotiations with the Russians, the Iranians, and the Syrian regime to cement a ceasefire while a longer political dialogue is ongoing between the Syrians.
Where would you hit Assad's regime? Where would you strike that would cause enough pain to bring them that what seems like a long distance to a negotiating table?
Well, look, what the regime knows, and everybody knows, it has very limited manpower and military hardware. So you can hit some of its aircrafts that doesn't have that many left of. It could hit some of its command and control bunkers. It could hit some of its weapon depots. This is a signal, once again. It's not meant to destroy the entire Syrian army, but to send it a credible signal that the United States and the international community is resolved to protect the civilians of Syria.
How do you think Russia would respond to that? Assad is their ally. They're heavily armed and on the scene.
Absolutely. The Russians will be very upset. They'll make a lot of noise at the United Nations. But you know what? That is all they're going to do. Because the Russians are not going to shoot down or attack the U.S. military for attacking Assad for using chemical weapons. This is, you know, it's a red herring to claim that we know that the Iranians or the Russians would want to start a war with the United States because we're responding to such human rights violations. This is not the same as responding to the United States attacking Russia, for example, where Putin and the Russian government would have every right to respond. But starting a war with us over sending such a limited but concise signal to the Syrian regime regarding the need to stop using chemical weapons against its people is a different ballgame, and I don't think it'll lead to World War III.
Wael Al-Zayed, please stand by there. Callers for all three of you. David in South Portland, Maine. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was calling. I wanted to find out what your panel thinks about the idea of what would happen if suddenly Assad wasn't there, whether that be something that somebody claims, like an assassination or something like that, or if it was just something innocuous, like a heart attack or something, where he just suddenly was not there. What would be the fallout in that region?
Robin Wright?
It's an interesting question. This is a man who's comparatively young and looks comparatively fit. But if he were to be removed, the problem is that you have an infrastructure that is quite loyal to the Assad regime, involves a lot of cousins and family members, people within the military, the intelligence community that were loyal to him. And so it's not just one man. You have a network, a entrenched bureaucracy that would be very hard, I think, to dismantle, and we shouldn't assume that all overnight that would disappear. There might be a military general, for example, who emerge, or a cousin, you know, someone within the family to emerge to try to continue the Assad dynasty. So, you know, it's not one man, and that's part of the problem.
Teddy in Beaufort, South Carolina. Teddy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I did not vote for President Trump, and I've had quite a bit of trouble being optimistic towards the presidency and this administration. But in the past couple days, with the removal of Mr. Bannon from a position he was totally unqualified for, and his vocal opposition to this chemical weapons use by Assad or whoever is using it, it's given me a little bit of optimism that this administration could have a productive role in international policy. I think it's extraordinarily important that we support the civilians who are dying in huge numbers in the Middle East. And I think in terms of the whole scheme of things, it will be very helpful for us to reduce the radical growth there, because we will have a positive impact on their lives in the Middle East.
And what are you saying, that you want intervention that would look like positive impact to you?
I think we need to intervene, maybe not so much militarily, but I, you know, as a resident of South Carolina, you know, Nikki Haley is now our representative to the UN.
Yeah.
I think we need to do something to say that, you know, this is not okay. And by who we are as the United States, which carries a lot of weight and a lot of meaning all across the world, to stand up and say, we are not going to allow this to continue. I think if we supported global action towards ending this human rights violating action there, you know, it would do a lot to, first of all, make me feel better about the presidency, and second of all, make America's standing in the world a little bit brighter.
Teddy, I appreciate your call. Let me take it to Nahal Tusi. Nahal, I mean, it is interesting here. Nikki Haley, now ambassador at the UN, with a much more kind of traditional, conventional American response to a shocking development like this than we have heard for a long time from the Trump administration. And in this same week, we have Steve Bannon out at from the Principals Committee of the National Security Council and General McMaster seeming to assert control there. What does that say to you, Nahal, about what's going on? Is the Trump administration tacking toward a more conventional foreign policy? Or, you know, toward what our caller describes as a productive role? Or is it looking overwhelmed here? What do you see, Nahal?
It's entirely possible that it's both of those things. It does seem to some degree that in many ways the Trump folks are veering toward a more traditional Republican type approach to national security. But it all kind of depends on the follow through in the long run. And this particular president, he has a short attention span, and he often, you know, pays the most attention to what he has the most recently heard. Now, Steve Bannon may be off the National Security Council, but he still has the president's ear, so he's still going to retain a lot of influence in the White House, probably including on national security types of issues. And in terms of, you know, these threats that Nikki Haley and others are making, once again, it just all comes down to follow through, what they choose to do, and whether choosing to do that will actually make an immediate difference, or if it's just going to lead perhaps to a short pause in, say, chemical weapons attacks or other types of deplorable actions by the Assad regime. But perhaps, you know, down the line, they might find a way to do it again. And then the question is, well, what will the Trump administration do then? So it's about the long term. It's not just about the immediate thing. And go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask Wael, if I may, how do you see, Wael Al-Zayat, how do you see General McMaster now perhaps mastering the National Security Council with Steve Bannon, who's been such a big player off there? Does that, to your mind, knowing McMaster's sort of quite prominent background and line of thinking here, does that make intervention more or less likely?
I think ultimately, with such important decision-making, this is going to rest with the president. Despite, his advisors and generals' recommendations, at the end of the day, the president of the United States will have to make this decision. And as part of the previous administration, I saw firsthand, a tortuous debate within the Obama administration of those who advocated a more assertive U.S. response to Assad's atrocities and those who were weary of the long-term consequences, and rightly so. And ultimately, clearly, President Obama sided with those who favored staying out of the conflict directly. I suspect that the same dynamics will play in this White House, because you're also going to have advisors who will be cautioning the president from getting entangled in another Middle Eastern war. The one thing we need to understand, that from my humble experience covering Syria, working under two administrations, we will continue to see the Syrian regime violate the human rights and dignity and the lives of the people of Syria until it is credibly deterred. And I heard the caller mention that preferably without limited means. I'm by no means a hawk myself, but I've come to the conclusion that until and unless someone is willing to do that, unfortunately, I think the carnage will continue in Syria.
Ryan in Detroit. Thank you for calling, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's your question?
Wayne State University.
Hi, yes. So my question is how, if we do go in, how are we going to treat this differently than the Iraq war with Saddam Hussein? And also, if we do go in, is that an American first policy? War is very tragic. So I'm just curious about that.
Robin Wright?
Boy, that's a good question. And the truth is, we had no-fly zones in Iraq for, 5 years, and we still had to go in with troops on the ground. And what we thought was going to be a short war ousting Saddam Hussein, we ended up there 8 years. And that's, again, the Pottery Barn rule, that once you go in, you militarily, you kind of assume automatically some responsibility for what happens next. And Syria is very different from Iraq. In some ways, it is messier, more complex because there's so many different players, and because there are four different wars that are playing out in Iraq. You have Assad versus the opposition. You have the ISIS war. You have a kind of veneer of sectarian strife within, and then you have the proxy wars between different Arab powers, and then, of course, with the underlay of the United States versus the Russians. It's a much more complex situation. I'm not sure that military action would expedite a resolution of this. It would be nice to think so. But it is, after almost 100 days in power, it is the Trump administration's first big crisis, first big test. And the president, who's been under siege for the failure of whether it's his legislative agenda or his travel ban, needs to be seen to be doing something, to act with strength and decisively. And the question is, will his response really be part of a reaction as president to his own the public perceptions about him, or will this be determined by what his National Security Council team says? I think there will be real concern within the Pentagon about, okay, if we do take out, whether it's command and control or fixed-wing aircraft or helicopters that are dropping barrel bombs, what is our broader strategy, and what is our exit strategy? How deeply involved do we want to be engaged? And I think those questions are pretty tough. And you have, with H.R. McMaster exerting control of the National Security Council, and a former general himself, and well as the Secretary of Defense, who's a well-seasoned in both Iraq and Afghanistan, you will have some sober minds addressing the complexities of this issue.
Wael Al-Zayat, our time is short, but can you intervene and have it line up with an America First policy, if that sort of Steve Bannon line is still the operative rule?
You can, but you definitely need to work within a coalition, and you need to tether it to a serious political plan that includes the key stakeholders in the region that Robin alluded to. The Russians, the Turks, the Saudis. Even need a back channel probably to Hezbollah and the Israelis. I know it's complicated, but that's the hard work of a superpower. And last time I checked, we still are.
Boy, that sounds to me like a lot for this administration to bite off right now. We'll see. Wael Al-Zayat, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Nahal Tusi with Politico. Thank you, Nahal, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Robin Wright, thank you as always for joining us. Great to have you today, Robin.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for all of your comments as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.